Good morning. Our speaker today, Matthew Russell, is currently the State Food Policy Project Coordinator at the Drake Agricultural Law Center. His projects have included institutional purchasing, research into Iowa's evolving pork industry, farm-to-school efforts, and the nexus of healthy eating and regional food systems. Currently, he coordinates the Greater Des Moines Buy Fresh, Buy Local campaign and works with farms, businesses, government agencies, and nonprofits to develop opportunities for Iowa-grown foods. Matt and his husband Patrick Stanley operate Coyote Run Farm and market fresh produce, eggs, and meat at farmers markets and other local outlets. They founded the farm in 2005 and are rehabilitating the 110 acres using sustainable agriculture and relational marketing. Matt also serves on the board of the Iowa Network for Community Agriculture, the Marion County Development Commission, and the USDA's State Farm Service Agency Committee. So please welcome our speaker, Matt Russell.
Does this advance the slides by any chance?
Pardon?
Does this advance the slides?
No.
No. Oh, okay. I might need somebody to advance as I pointed them. Or I can take the microphone and go back and do it myself, but I don't have to stand at the podium. I don't think the cord's long enough. Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be here. I haven't been with First Friday Breakfast Club for a number of years. I live 40 miles away, and so to be into Des Moines by 7 means I need to leave at 6. And I do that once in a while to get to Drake, but if I don't have to, I don't. But it's been about 10 years ago that I was at First Friday Breakfast Club fairly regularly for about a year before going to graduate school at Iowa State and then ending up down at our farm. But what's interesting is almost every time I was here, I had some connection to somebody that grew up in my hometown. I grew up in Anita, Iowa, population 1,000 in Cass County, about an hour west of here. Always kind of some connection. And then today I sit down and I'm forgetting your first name.
Doug
Opperly. And I don't know if you, do you say Opperly or?
Opperly,
okay. Well, anyway, his cousin grew up just like 2 miles from my grandpa's farm. His grandma moved into the house next door to my grandparents in Messina, Iowa, population 400 in Cass County. So there's always this connection to rural Iowa around GLBT. And when I moved back to Iowa in 1999, I'd been living in Las Vegas for a couple years teaching. And I'd come back, and as I was coming out and wanting to figure out how to integrate who I was as a gay man, that I found Des Moines and Iowa in general to be a really healthy place to do that. And people from around the country that knew me thought that was really weird, that like I would come to Iowa, to, especially leaving Las Vegas. Well, I thought Las Vegas was very dysfunctional. And I, trying to come out in a healthy way as a gay man. And Iowa was this tremendous place where people were very accepting and open-minded, and there was a very healthy community of older, middle-aged, younger gay men and women that were integrated with a broader community. And so when you went to the garden, there was this big range of people, gay, straight, older, younger, ethnically mixed. And in Las Vegas, when you went to the club, you either went to the young club or the older club, or it was very segmented. So I just want to share how, and I'm going to talk a little bit today about the food system, but then also tie it into how there's a parallel with this diversity that's happening in the food system and what that means for diversity in terms of who can participate. And this great place like Iowa, how couples like my husband and I are able to live in a rural setting and make it work. So, next slide. I work at the Drake Agricultural Law Center. I've been there 6 years, and my job is to really help Iowa eat more of what we grow and grow more of what we eat. There's a real both-and opportunity here. We're not going to lessen our influence in global supply chain agriculture, but we have the opportunity to develop a whole bunch of additional farms and businesses with what I call this food movement. And I put on the table, Jonathan passed out the Buy First, Buy Local food guide. That's this year's food guide. It's 81 farms, 31 or 32 businesses. All our members supporting each other, trying to help people, educate people about how to get a hold of great, fresh, local foods. Next slide, please. And this is our farm. It's 110 acres, and we're doing chemical-free produce, about an acre and a half of it. We do grass-based beef at our farm, the farm I grew up on. My parents and brother and sister-in-law are still doing grain-finished beef, and so we sell both kinds of beef through our farm and our brand. And then we do eggs, and I have equines, which I keep telling my husband is a business venture, but it really isn't. Nobody makes money with horses unless you're selling people with horses something. But, next slide. And this is my husband, Patrick Stanley. He grew up in Des Moines, West Des Moines and Des Moines, and lived and worked his whole life here in Des Moines until I drug him off to the farm. Actually, I didn't drag him. We were very excited to do that together. But he farms full-time. He spent a year. We both worked in Des Moines, and he commuted back and forth to the zoo. And then after a year being on the farm, he was able to quit and go full-time. So he farms full-time, and I work off the farm full-time, but also farm with all my extra time. Next slide. And very much a family affair. Pat and I, two weeks ago, the 28th of June, celebrated our ninth wedding anniversary. And we had our families. It was the first time his nine siblings had all been together in 20-some years. His parents were deceased. My parents and all my two siblings and their significant others or spouse. And we had a minister, and we never dreamed that our sacramental marriage would ever be recognized by the state of Iowa. And we were very delighted to be able to file the paperwork, so to speak. But our families have been very involved in the farm, and we also invite lots of people out to our farm. Next slide. So I want to talk just for about 5 minutes about the social movement around food and what's happening. So if you think about a continuum, we all eat on a continuum. And agriculture, healthy agriculture, should fit that continuum. So one end of the continuum is a very highly efficient, global, industrialized, globally sourced and supplied food sector. And we do that really well in Iowa, you know, with corn and soybeans and pork and turkeys and laying hens and eggs. And then a whole number of smaller things, but really phenomenal agriculture that's really about the global supply chains. And when we go to the grocery store, most of what we're grabbing at the grocery store is from that global supply chain. At the other end, very far end, is how many people in here have planted anything that they're going to eat this year? Tomatoes, peppers, okay? So that's the other extreme, is like growing it yourself. And what we've done in the last 50 to 75 years is we've developed the one end of the continuum incredibly well. And we really took our eye off the other end of the continuum. What's exciting is in the last 10 or 15 years, longer among the pioneers, the folks in the organic movement and other pioneer kind of folks. But in the last 10 years, it's really become mainstream that we're thinking about that other end of the continuum, and now starting to think about all along that continuum. And so this movement around food, I think about it on that continuum. It's not an either or, it's a both and, but we haven't developed the one end very well, and now we're starting to do that. So one of the reasons we're starting to do that is because we assume the conventional wisdom is that food would always be cheaper and it would always be more convenient. And we really train people to be unconscious about their food, to just take it for granted and not think about it. And so what happened was, and I use this as a benchmark for me, in 2000 I was working for the National Catholic Rural Life Conference here in Iowa, working nationally on sustainable agriculture and food system stuff. There was a product that came out in Newsweek. It was called Incredibles. And if you think about orange sherbet ice cream, the push-ups, how many have had a push-up? Okay, so you know the technology, right? It's the cardboard, stick on the side, break it off, push in the bottom, and you just... And it's like a dessert, it's a treat. It was actually in Messina where our grandmas lived. That was the Sinclair station. Grandma would take us and get push-ups. That was a big treat. Well, somebody decided that they could use that technology for a meal. And so, hit the button, please. This is the Incredible. It came out in macaroni and cheese and sausage and eggs. And they had another couple things that they were developing. And it got this spot in Newsweek. It's like the next hottest thing in convenience food. It failed miserably. It never made it to the marketplace. And I've got a rural sociology degree from Iowa State, so I think like a sociologist, I'm like, you know, that was too much. That was too much. So your meal, you think about it, you're in the kitchen, you run into the freezer, you grab it out of the freezer, you throw it in the microwave, you finish getting ready, you grab your books for school or your bag for the office or whatever, and you grab it from the microwave and you head to your car, and you can just shove it in your mouth as you're going to work or going wherever. Right? This was it. If you can think about convenience food, if you can think about not thinking about your food, I call it being alienated from the whole food system. This is it. No people involved. Not even a table. No utensils. It's just salt, fat, and sugar, tasty, by myself in the car. Well, the conventional wisdom was that's where the global supply chains were headed. Convenience and absolute inexpense and on-demand food alienated from what we've typically think of as meals and that kind of thing. And it has consequences because we now have in the Western world, the United States leading the charge, a huge problem of food-related diseases. And so in the last 10 years, we've really stepped back, 12, 15 years, and stepped back, and people are starting to think differently. And we've got the First Lady out there talking about healthy things. We've got a White House garden. There's all kinds of things. So click the next slide. People want real food again. And it doesn't mean that they're going to stop going to the grocery store, but they're now going to add to their mix other options. And options like Coyote Run Farm and what you see in the Buy Fresh, Buy Local guides. People are hungry to reconnect. And they're so hungry to reconnect that they'll even do crazy things like come to our farm, next slide please, to our chicken butchering party. So we've done this 4 or 5 times now. When we change our laying flock, we just put an all call out to our customer base and say, you know, chicken butchering party 2 weeks from Sunday, everybody that wants to come help. And we don't get a lot of repeats, okay? But we do get between 12 and 25 people that show up. And it's older people who did this as kids. It's older people who bring their kids to share with them what grandma went through or what their parents went through. It's college kids who want the experience. So that just illustrates how motivated people are to not just do the conventional wisdom, but to try to reconnect. Next slide. So this is a great opportunity in Iowa. It's commodity ag, it's global supply chains, and it's local foods and retail agriculture. And you can just click through this. I'm not going to go through all of this, but... it's very different. If you think about my parents' farm, commodity, 1,000-acre corn and soybeans, you know, on the product, they don't have to think about what they're going to grow. They grow corn, soybeans, cattle, you know. Pat and I, we grow like 25 different vegetable crops. When I went to the FSA office to certify our acreage last week, the lady, when she opened our folder and looked at our map from last year, I'm not making this up, she opened it and went, "Oh my God." Because she doesn't see that kind of thing. But here's the exciting thing, is that we have an administration right now that's very interested, led by our own Tom Vilsack, very interested in making sure that all of those programs in USDA are applicable to farms like mine and Pat's, as well as other diverse farms. So it's a very exciting time. Lots of diversity in the food system. Okay, you can click to the next slide. So lots of diversity. There's some more chicken butchering. We're at the farmer's market. This is a farm crawl on the bottom right there. I don't know if people know Leslie and Lisa. You might recognize them. And I think it's Connie and Deb, too. So a lot of our customers are from the LGBT community. We didn't set out to do that. we just showed up at the farmer's market, but Pat and I are very friendly. We talked to people. It didn't take long for people to just kind of connect. So we're very proud that we have connected with a lot of folks in the LGBT community. And something that happened with me and Pat, and this is where I'm going to shift and talk about, so we got the food system stuff that's creating opportunities. Now how rural Iowa and the food system and other kinds of things are both creating an opportunity for couples like me and Pat, but also how the work of the LGBT community and this healthy environment that for 20, 30 years ago, I would argue Iowa was one of the best places to be gay because it wasn't a ghetto. You had to integrate with other people. And for the most part, Iowans are fairly open-minded, except for a few. Very vocal few, but for the most part, people very tolerant. So one of the things that Pat and I decided was that, you know, we've paid a price for being gay because we grew up gay and all the angst and all kinds of things. But we never really got bullied, either one of us. And we never lost our jobs. We never had that kind of, paid that kind of a price. And we also have moved through our lives with kind of being able to share with folks if we want that we're gay and not share with folks and kind of let it slide or whatever. And we were kind of doing that with our farm. But when the Supreme Court justices lost their jobs because of what they did, Pat and I talked about it and we decided we've got to do something different. And so I do a lot of speaking around the state. And what I did prior to that election was that I would say, I always talked about Pat and the farm, but I always say my partner Pat. And that allowed people to think about whether, those who were kind of not clueless would think, okay, they're married, or they're a same-sex couple. And those who didn't want to think that way would just say, oh, they're business partners. Right? We really let people. And so the default was, I'd say partners. And then once in a while, in certain settings, I would say my husband. Well, I shifted. Because I thought, we have got to say my husband every time. And I do actually a lot of interviewing. And in fact, that suggested my name, Jonathan, and told me, that asked to have me come speak, had heard me on public radio last year with Charity Nebbe talking about the food system. And Charity said, your partner. And I responded by saying, blah, 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 my husband, Pat, blah, blah, blah. She picked up on it. So then the next time, and we just had a very natural conversation about the food system in which a same-sex couple were talking about each other in a very normalized way. And I was surprised at how, that's probably the, because that's statewide and it has a little more coverage. I get on TV once in a while, and if I talk about the farm, I always say my husband. That was a shift that we made. But that was very profound. We had a lot of people come up to us at the farmer's market and say, thank you very much. That was just wonderful to hear. So there's, let me just say just a moment about, go to the next slide, I think. Yeah, that's, if you want to reach me, there's our website for the farm, the website at Drake, and my email at Drake, and you're certainly welcome to talk to me. And I'll just say a couple more things, and then we'll open for questions. Pat and I moved down to rural Marion County, and Pat had never lived out of Des Moines. I grew up in rural Iowa. Pat's approach was, let's just keep to ourselves. And I said, no thank you, because there is a story that's going to be written here, and I want to make sure that we at least are providing some content, because it's going to be a lot better than what they make up. Right? So I went knocking on doors as soon as we closed on the property, knocking on doors and saying, hey, And I didn't say, hey, we're your gay neighbors. I just said, hey, we bought this farm, we're moving in. And but I think for the most part, people put things together. And if they don't, they don't. But I think they do. And when we go to the farm supply store, and I walk in, and Maureen, who's from the family who owns the store, says, how you doing, Matt? How are things going? Hey, say hi to Pat, or how's Pat doing? Right? It's like, there's indicators that they know. And when Pat goes in, she says, "Hey, say hi to Matt." And they came to the farm crawl. You know, we had 1,500 people do this thing with seven other farms first weekend in October. You know, we don't put any energy into trying to, you know, indicate that we're living like brothers, right? we're a married couple. We talk about the fact with our neighbors that Pat's got health insurance through Drake, right? I mean, those are indicators that you've got to be really clueless not to pick up on. But people have just really welcomed us. They've welcomed our diverse agriculture. We've had no issues with our neighbor. We've had a couple spray issues and things. But for the most part, people are excited that there is this 110-acre farm that conventional wisdom said should have been bulldozed and added to another farm. Instead, we've carved it out, and it's a standalone farm, working enterprise. We've rehabilitated the house. In 2010, we redid the house. We actually wrote checks out of our account for over $200,000. Now, I did not come from a wealthy family. $200,000 seems like a whole lot of money. And we were spending it in rural Iowa. The guys that lifted the house, that poured the basement, that did the electrical work. We generally spend about $60,000 a year in rural Iowa, in the ag economy. They don't care that we're gay. They care that our check's clear. They care that we're calling them to come do some work on our farm, or that we're hiring their kids for this summer, right? So that's enough for what I'll just say. It's exciting because we have an administration that has said more than any administration in the past that it's okay to be LGBT and that you make a difference. And on the food side, we have an administration that has said, we want diverse agriculture. We want not just one kind of agriculture. We want all kinds of agriculture. So whoever you support in the election, we have to make sure that those principles stay, because it's really important for Iowa that we have diverse populations and that we have diverse agriculture. And now if anybody has comments or questions, and Jonathan, you just tell us when we need to quit. Yeah.
How are you handling with your crops and like genetic manipulation of crops around you?
We're very fortunate because we only have an acre and a half of produce, and we have 110 acres. So we've been able to pretty much build a buffer around our whole farm. The only remaining piece is across the road. But it's on the east side of the road, so the prevailing winds very infrequently blow. So spray drift is the biggest problem that we have. As far as genetic engineering, I think the property issue is really important in that area, because, and it's evolving, and we'll see how that plays out in the coming years. But the challenge is that those genes have been released, and you can't really pull them back very well. And in the past, there have been companies who have said, when those genes come onto your property, then it's your fault, and you're liable for using our technology. And I think we're shifting to, and now I think we're coming back around, and people are saying, wait, if it's your property that comes on my property, and affects what I'm doing. And I think that's a longer arc, but I think that's where we're headed legally, and that has the potential to disrupt agribusiness in a pretty significant way. So there's a lot of pushback, but that's I'll tell you one thing. What it's been really helpful for is our marketing, right? Because you can't go to the grocery store and get things that aren't genetically modified in the United States, and it's not labeled, and so you can't know. So it helps us build relationships with customers because we can tell them this is what we're growing. We're doing chemical free. We're doing heirloom varieties, open pollinated varieties. And if you come on down and see it. If come to our farm if you want to come in. You might have to kill chickens when you come, but.
Is there any standardization of definition of what is and not organic?
Yeah. The USDA has, in the United States, the USDA has established a rule around organic. And so you will generally see. I just had some Organic Valley milk this morning, and right on the top it had USDA organic. You'll see that label. It took about 10 years to actually get that rule established. And Kathleen Merrigan, who's the deputy undersecretary for USDA, she was very much in charge or in leading that effort. But it took a long time. And we're seeing kind of an erosion of that. And this is natural. I mean, this is what happens in markets, is so that you establish the standard, and then everyone kind of comes down to the standard, right? And in the past, the organic movement was all about pushing the limits up and being better and better and better and more organic. And then once it became codified, then it became kind of, the pressure came back down to meet that bar, to meet the certification. I don't think that's necessarily a horrible thing. Organic is still very good. But what it's done is it's created another opportunity in the marketplace so that people that want organic can go and buy organic Oreo cookies. But the folks who really aren't looking for organic Oreo cookies, they're looking for Whole Foods and heirloom varieties and those kinds of things. They're now not just looking for organic. They're looking for something that they're not finding on the store shelves labeled organic. And so as the values kind of went down, Local Foods has created another up arc of values that has created more markets for farms. So it's very, very very defined. Organic is very defined. Yeah?
Yeah, there are a couple new merchants in town that talk about having Whole Foods or et cetera, organic foods. Have they contacted any of your associates about buying their products?
That's a great question. There's been two things. Whole Foods is coming to town, and so they did an all call to folks. They have some pretty stringent requirements in order to sell in their store, so they're more a corporate model, and so it's a little bit of a higher hurdle to get into Whole Foods. They've hired some good folks from the local foods movement to work in the store, and they certainly have talked about wanting to source local and organic and natural and all that. So we'll see how that plays out. I'm optimistic. And also, you know, they're the gorilla in the room, and so it's putting a lot of pressure on other businesses in Iowa and greater Des Moines. So we'll see how that plays out. But Hy-Vee just got a new produce buyer, director of produce at corporate level. And I only know this because he talked to Pat, my husband Pat. He went through our Buy Fresh, Buy Local directory and called all of the produce folks, saying, what do you got, and do you have any interest in selling to Hy-Vee? So the market demand is not just the farmer's market, but we're seeing, and Gateway Market for years, once they opened, they've been very flexible working with farmers. I know Whole Foods has a very high threshold, and I think Gateway's threshold has gone up a little bit, but when they were first open and they were first trying to recruit farmers, they basically would talk to farmers, and then farmers would bring them product and they'd actually pay them right on the spot. And so, you know, that was like a seller's market, right? Because your buyer is so motivated that they're going to just, like, thank you for bringing it in and write you a check. So there's a lot of activity going on in the marketplace, and the challenge is to develop that and really institutionalize it and develop not just great farms but the supporting businesses and those kinds of things. So that's why I'm saying this is a both-and opportunity. It's not all about shifting Iowa agriculture away from global supply chains into local. It's about taking what we have and smaller acreages that make almost no difference to our total corn and soybean output and adding value in new businesses and new farms and new opportunities. So, great question. Yeah?
Are you working with the urban garden movement here in Des Moines and the one that is using immigrants and new immigrants to create these new plots all over the city, sponsored by churches, and are you familiar with that? And is that competing with you?
Yeah, great question. Yes, we're very involved. In fact, we have a new program this year with Buy Fresh, Buy Local called Go the Distance. And Go the Distance, Plant a Mile. So we're taking Kitchen Collage and the Richard Deming Foundation stepped up and said, we want this to happen. And so they sponsored it. And DMARC, Des Moines Area Religious Council, said, yeah, we'll get volunteers and we'll figure out how to use the food. And then last week or 2 weeks ago, we did a weeding party at this farm where we're growing a mile with the produce. And Lutheran Services in Iowa, their refugee program, they had like five or six of their refugees that joined us to go do that. We've just written a grant at Drake. We're hopeful that it's going to come in, but we wrote one with Proteus to work with immigrant farm laborers, and one with Lutheran Services in Iowa for the refugees who are from farms, mostly in Southeast Asia, who want to farm here. And then the urban gardening piece, we've been very supportive of that, very interested. We don't actually do a lot of work around that other than sometimes there's legal issues or, you know, zoning issues, or we'll field questions about that. But it's not a competitor. It's a support.
So how realistically, as just a normal consumer, do you see in the future that we can walk into Dolls or Hy-Vee and know when we pick up a carton of Anderson Ericsson milk or a carton of Dolls eggs, to know that those were produced in Iowa or that milk comes from an Iowa cow?
You can actually be fairly certain that that's happening because there would probably be some exceptions where eggs might be on the shelf that weren't from Iowa. But because we're number one in egg production, most of the eggs on all the Iowa grocery store shelves are going to be locally grown. And most of the milk, it might come from Nebraska, it might come from Missouri farm, but most of the milk is also, because eggs travel better than milk, but milk is still fairly regional. The where you're going to get globally sourced stuff is when you get into yogurts and stuff where they have milk protein concentrate and other kind of additives. So it's going to be hard to know. I've been doing this work for a long time and I feel like I know a lot, and I still can't go into the grocery store and figure out where everything's coming from. I think part of the food movement is Michael Pollan's been very important in writing and getting people, you know, conscious again about their food. Is this notion of where you're shopping in the grocery store. So if you're shopping in the dairy case and you're buying milk, or you're buying just kind of regular cheese, and when you look at it, the ingredients, there's no, you know, letters. It's just like milk and an enzyme, or, you know, maybe some salt. So the more of your whole food products are more likely grown locally, more likely, and also healthier for you. And then the longer the ingredient list becomes, and the less it's on the outside of the grocery store, the more that it's in the middle of the grocery store, those things become, you know, filled with a lot more additives, and as they like to say, in the foodies like to say, you know, if your grandma doesn't recognize it as food, it's probably not. Somebody over here.
Someone asked an old farmer, "What do you do if someone gave him $1 million?" And he said, "I farm till it's all gone." So you have 100 acres, and in certain parts of the state where that'd be $10,000-$15,000 an acre. So you could easily invest $1 million to $1.5 million in this farm, of which you have an acre that you're growing food on?
An acre and a half of produce. Then we've got 80 acres in pasture, rotational system with beef and poultry.
At what point in time does a farm like that, are you able to start, you say that Pat's working there full time now.
Yeah.
For the average person, at what point in time does that farm, is that able to support itself?
Well, the farm so far has supported itself. What it has not done is paid for groceries or insurance or anything like that. So this is part of the work I do at Drake, is helping people understand where the opportunities are. So for young people that think, well, I just want to go farm, and, you know, I don't need to make that much, you know, if I could make $20,000 or $25,000 a year and I could just go farm. Well, farming's is a business, and if you do the global supply chain stuff, it's a relatively big small business where you're talking millions of dollars of capitalization, and you're probably connected to a family member. You know, there's a few exceptions where people are get into farming because they're working with somebody, and then that person kind of takes them under their wing and helps them with lets them have some equipment, and it's still possible for somebody who's not connected directly to a family member for their farm to get into industrial agriculture. It's still possible, but it's challenging, and it's still highly capitalized. The farming that Pat and I are doing, you know, we started with about we bought it in 2005, and so the land was worth about $1,500 an acre. Today it's worth about $3,500 an acre. And it would be much harder to do today than it was in 2005. We probably wouldn't be looking at 110 acres. We'd be looking at probably more like 40 or 50 acres. And then the business model, and I knew this going into it, the business model was not that we would cash flow in terms of making money, you know, net income for 10 years. And we're pretty much on target for that. That by the time we get to 10 years, we'll have our production system up enough. We'll have invested in the production system. We will have depreciated and paid for most of those inputs, and we will start paying taxes. But up until now, the farm has paid for itself. It's paid it for the most part all the operating and all the equipment and most of the interest. The only thing it probably hasn't paid for is the principal. The principal on the farm. That's coming currently from off-farm income. So it's not a get-rich scheme, but we are building wealth much faster than if we had both stayed working our, you know, $30,000-$40,000 a year jobs. We've made some changes since then, but you know, when we bought the farm, that's, you know, Pat was making the 30s and I was making the upper 30s, and had we just kept those jobs and had incremental increases in, you know, cost of living kinds of things, we're a lot wealthier right now than if we'd have done that.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
We appreciate it, and it is a tradition to give a token of appreciation, which is a recording of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus, which we hope you and Pat will enjoy.
We will. Thank you.
Thank you
this
very much.
This is 2003.
Yep. They haven't had a recent
rendition. I think I've sang on this.
So, Matthew provides us with a whole new dimension in integration, and he's a walking, talking testimony to gay people being normal, not normative. We aren't by any means the majority, but we are perfectly normal, perfectly authentic, real, when we are out and out there in the community, living our lives and making contributions, it defies stereotypes, it teaches. And now we know that in rural Marion County there is a little pocket of enlightenment, and that is actually contagious, and we appreciate the contribution that you're making there. Thank you. Want to encourage those of you who are here for the first time particularly, but everyone, to attend our upcoming meetings and to provide you some intriguing reasons to be here again. August the 3rd, which will be our next meeting, our speaker is going to be Donna Redwing, the new head of One Iowa. She spoke to our group when she was a regional coordinator for HRC, perhaps 10 or 12 years ago. She's now back in Iowa, leading One Iowa, and is going to be our speaker in August. In September the 7th, Justice Mike Strait is going to be our speaker. He is one of the three justices who was removed from the Iowa Supreme Court by a vote of some of the people, and he's going to be providing us some insights in that experience of martyrdom in September. In October, Carol Greta, who was the longtime in-house attorney for the Iowa Department of Education and a behind-the-scenes strong supporter of education around our issues and support for anti-bullying efforts, and she's going to be our speaker in October. In November, on the 2nd of November, Polk County Sheriff Bill McCarthy is going to be our speaker. So we have some outstanding speakers upcoming, and we look forward to seeing you at each of those meetings. Thanks for being today.